It's the Escape Artist Podcast at DonkeyJawProjects.com, hosted by yours truly, Marshall Couture, also known as Black.
We make, relate, create, it's change harness. The soul within the comics and movies that they market. Activating people's imaginations, the target, work the hardest. With passion and heart, it's Escape Artist.
All right,
artist.
What's up, everybody? This is Marshall Couture, also known as Plex in hip-hop circles. And you're listening to Donkey Jaw Projects, or actually the Escape Artist podcast of DonkeyJawProjects.com. And today we have a special guest and a special host. Today for the host, we got Mr. Peter Palmiotti, who is our tech engineer of the day for Google Hangouts because... We got some feedback already. Dan, can you use headphones maybe? Or
me?
Yeah.
Sure, man, no problem. That's easy.
Oh, that might be me.
Is that you?
That is me. All right, see, technical difficulties already. But Peter's on top of it. We already had some issues, and we got those fixed.
Yeah.
So, I think I muted Dan there. Are you there, Dan, now? Oh, here, let me... Turn him back up. All right, are you there now, Dan?
Yes.
Okay, so, yes, we have special host Peter Palmiotti, and he's helping us with the hosting and with the technical stuff. And, of course, we wanted to talk to Mr. Dan Fraga. How you doing, man?
Doing well. I just fresh out of the dentist chair. I'm doing really well, though.
Awesome. Are y'all numb and ready?
Yeah. I got the tinglies on this side of the face. It's like the numb is coming down. It's an interesting feeling. At least I'm not drooling. That's all I'm happy about. Just that there's no
and
stuff
you're coherent.
Coming out. Yeah. Yeah. No gas. Just the needle.
Sweet. Alrighty, so, yeah, aside from dental things and all that, I guess I was going to start off with a few questions just to get this sparked up, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Sounds good.
Cool. So, of course, I got to ask some of the basic questions that you would normally get asked in an interview, because I'm super curious, and, you know... I'd love to hear, like, kind of where did you start as far as, like, inspiration? I was reading today that animation was a big inspiration from the get-go with your art.
Yeah.
But, yeah, is that pretty much what inspired you to say, you know what, I think this is what I want to try to do for my career?
No, there were a couple of factors that were involved. I mean, there are parts of animation that blew my mind when I was really young, before I knew I wanted to draw. I got this Fisher-Price crank animation thing where you put cartridges in, and it was the Mickey Mouse, Lonesome Ghosts, and I kept going backwards and forwards and seeing how it was creating motion, and I thought that was really neat. I bought a few comic books. My first comic was this Batman comic back in like 82, but what really got me hooked on comics in general as like just collecting, not the drawing part, was Marvel Universe Handbook. It was like number 5, and yeah. John Byrne had drawn all these covers, and what had happened was inside it was sort of an encyclopedia, but they would put, you know, first appearance, you know, that sort of thing. And so I went down to my Quick Mart where I bought the Marvel Universe, and I asked the guy behind the counter, "Hey, where's Hulk 181? This Wolverine guy came from Hulk. Where do you keep it?" Like, you know, I'm like this dumb 11-year-old, and he's like, "We get rid of them as, you know, as soon as the next one comes in, we send the other ones back." And some ominous dude, I wish I could thank him, but he's like, "You should just go down to the comic book store." And I was baffled. There's a store for comics. So I went down there, and I had bought a Cloak and Dagger miniseries issue. A G.I. Joe, the one where Clutch is falling out of, I forget if it's 17 or 21, but he's falling towards the ground, and it said something like "Home, Clutch going home" or something like that. And obviously, I was like every other kid, I like G.I. Joe. So there was a couple of covers that I tried to copy, like the Mike Zeck one with Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow. Then I started trying to copy the Cloak and Dagger stuff just out of I enjoyed the artwork. I wasn't trying to be a comic book artist. Another factor was my grandfather. He was an artist, an oil painter. In fact, behind me, if I point that guy, War guy back there, he painted that, and there's some other paintings on my wall in my office here that he painted. But he was sort of a traditional artist, and he was sort of encouraging me, if you want to draw, you know, you can come to one of my classes. And he was teaching some stuff out of the Betty Edwards book, The Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. Right around that time is when Dark Knight came out, Frank Miller's Dark Knight. And I think the critical mass was, for me, of wanting to draw comic books happened twice. Once in 1986, when I saw the cover of Dark Knight number 2, and Batman was looking just grizzled and huge and wrinkly, and he had all those tears in his costume, and I was like, this does not look like the Batman I know. I love it. I want more, and I want to make shit like this. And then the other time was McFarlane had drawn the Wolverine and the Hulk, where the Hulk was in Wolverine's claws. Those were the two sort of like that made me go, I need to do this. So that's pretty much the long story of it.
That's awesome. That's so cool. And I think that Dark Knight stuff was, I think that was what hit for a lot of people. Because pretty much all of media, movies, comics have pretty much fallen suit after that.
Dude, 80, there was some magic in the air. And we were just talking before we went live, but 1986, you know what happened in 1986 in hip-hop? I mean, I know you know, but he's basically the guy who, he's like the Dark Knight of hip-hop. He changed everything from the Run DMC party rap to sort of more deep shit. Rakim.
Yeah,
Rakim dropped in 86. So 86 was a great year for comics. It was a great year for hip-hop. I can't even recall what movies came out that year, but for hip hop and comics,
I think a lot of stuff was getting that way. Really, I mean, that was like everybody just craved that kind of darker, more deeper type of, I guess, meaningful, but mostly just like a darker, edgier, realistic type of thing.
Yeah,
and like you said, Rakim came out, and then, you know, he was still kind of doing the party vibe, but he was bringing, like, some knowledge in and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what made people crave doing some stuff that was more towards the streets and expressing what they were going through, you know.
Yeah. Him and Schoolie D. Schoolie D was bringing some things that weren't even in hip-hop. He was talking about crack and prostitution before NWA, before Ice-T. But we're talking about comics, man. We could talk about hip hop all day.
Hey, this is a Escape Artist podcast. My audience knows that I go on rants sometimes about the music too. So
yeah,
it's all art inclusive. But
that's true.
Yeah,
that's
we
true.
Do talk a lot about comics too.
good.
So that's awesome to hear your first inspiration and everything. I love that. So I guess what I would go to next is, I mean, man, like, you don't hear this very often. We, a lot of the people who listen to this and are into this are kind of a bunch of artists that we all kind of know each other. And one person who's kind of come to the forefront recently through a podcast that Peter Palmiotti's part of, which is the Artcasters, Jay Ferguson, he's like one of the only people who I've heard this story, and then I'm thinking, and it made me think of you and him both, because you both started art careers really early in life.
Yeah.
And, so I'd love to hear a little bit about the experience of, you know, basically coming out of high school and being hired at Extreme Studios. Like, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'll rewind a little bit to 89, because 89 was sort of an impactful year for me on a personal level.
Okay.
I had this public access television show called Comic Review for You. It's on YouTube. There's like 2 episodes of it. I was like 16, and I would talk about comics and things. But one of the things that I would do, either out of naivete or just but also a thirst for knowledge, is I would try to find out through interview magazines and whatnot where my favorite artists were from, and then I would call information on the phone, you know, the phone directory, the 555-1212, and ask for people's phone numbers. So I used to call people like John Byrne, Mike Zeck, Arthur Adams, Eric Larson, and I would cold call them. I would just call them up and, like, talk to them. So here's this kid. Hey, what are you drawing right now? And, like, you know, that sort of thing. Carl Potts, fortunately, he and I had a mutual friend, and my friend Fred Jackson had hooked me up with Carl, and Carl helped me out. I had a fanzine, which was sort of a print version of my show, and Carl did I did an interview with Carl about breaking into comics. So, flash forward a little bit, I met Todd McFarlane in 1989 at a signing, and he was cool. And then I went to another show in San Francisco. I remember the day because, you know, you remember certain days in your life. It was November 19th of 1989, and I was going to do a segment on my show called How to get a portfolio review. And in that I went to this show, and the people that were guests at the show were Art Adams, Derek Robertson, Eric Larson, and Rob Liefeld. Rob Liefeld and Eric Larson were sitting next to each other, and on camera, I had Rob give a sort of a portfolio review of my work. And he was really cool. He was a nice dude. He had just got on New Mutants and had just finished up What If number 7, What If Wolverine, it was an Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. So he was I think he was like 22, I was like 16 at the time. Anyway, as a lot of artists do at the convention, he had a stack of these sketches that he had done, and on one of the sketches was a character design for this character from X-Force called Strife. He's like a villain, doppelganger of Cable. But unbeknownst to him, and unbeknownst to my friend Mike Gomez, who had bought the sketch at the time, the back of it was, he had drawn it on the back of his personal stationery. So here I have Rob Liefeld's fax number, his phone number, and his address, right? So what I did afterwards is I called him, and I said, hey, man, I'm the kid who did this, that, and the other. I got your name off of this thing. Sorry for bothering you. You're a young dude like me. You're only like 6 years older than me. Anyway, we formed sort of a friendship. I was more of a pest, really, you know, the guy that was bothering him all the time while he was working. But we ended up forming a friendship and talking. And during the 1991 San Diego Comic-Con, which was at the convention center it is now, it was the first year that it was there, summer that T2 came out, Terminator 2. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Rob. I met Marat, and Rob was telling me about this, about him, Eric Larson, and McFarlane were going to start their own comic company. No, nothing about leaving Marvel. Just, you know, he was going to start a comic company,
right.
And I was shopping my stuff to Marvel and DC. So the thought of like shopping it to him hadn't even occurred to me. So. Brian Augustin, I forget how you say his name, and Neil Posner were these editors at DC that were giving me some attention, a lot of sample scripts. But I had gone back and back and back and back. I had done like every inventory tryout story that they could throw at somebody. And rewinding a little bit, 1991 is when I graduated high school, and on my 18th birthday, my stepfather told me I had a month to move out. and be on my own. So I basically moved out. So here I am. I'm working four jobs. I work for Diamond Comics in their warehouse, Velvet Turtle as a busboy, American Eagle Outfitters, and Interactive Composition, which was this like textbook company. So I'm working four jobs to support myself and doing samples. So feeling like every time I sent a sample off, like, this is going to be my big break, this is going to be my big break, and then they kick it back and go, no, it's not quite there, you know, you didn't draw this that well, your hands are looking better. You know, they basically gave me diagnostics, but right. I was feeling really discouraged. So anyway, fast forward, San Diego Comic Con, Rob's telling me about this thing. Right around November, he's telling me that he's going to start putting out more books through his studio, but had no, there was no mention of me coming to work for him yet, and I had almost joined the Navy. I mean, I had gone down the recruiter. I was done trying to send my samples out, feeling kind of discouraged, which is dumb. I'd only really tried hardcore for like 2 years. But I got a call from him saying that if I would move down to Southern California, I'm from the Bay Area up by San Francisco, that I could come join his studio. So I basically said, goodbye. Goodbye, Bay Area. I'm moving down to L.A.
Wow.
I moved down to I first came and did sort of a scout visit in February of 92, and that's one of my favorite moments in comics happened then. It's when CNN had come down to the studio when Image was announced that the seven guys had left Marvel. And I was there for when CNN had come and talked to them. And I remember dinner after the interview, all seven guys, plus Marat, plus me, are all eating Chinese dinner, and it's at this round table. And I remember sort of swiveling my head around and thinking, like, holy shit, I'm in the Pantheon, you know? Like, there's Jim Lee, there's Mark Silvestri, there's Todd, there's Eric, there's all these guys, and thinking, like, I felt like I won the lottery or something, you know? It was one of those, like, what am I doing here? Like, I'm the luckiest boy on earth, you know, that sort of feeling. But it wasn't until, like, October of that year that Rob gave me anything to do, and it was, I was basically sharpening pencils and taking out the trash and, like, doing transfers for him, because he would draw his layouts, like, about that big, and he'd blow them up on a copier, and somebody had to light box them so he could pencil over them. So I was doing that. I was spotting blacks, filling in blacks, a lot of studio work. But also, as I also wanted to take the initiative, and it's something I try to push for other people, is don't wait for the opportunity, make the opportunity. So I was basically working on my own stories, and right around October or so, two things happened. He needed a pinup for Brigade, which was printed in number two, and he was going to miss his deadline for Youngblood Zero, and he needed a block of pages. So what he did is he basically appropriated some of the pages from my samples, and we redrew some of the characters I had drawn in as Youngblood characters, like Die Hard and Chapel, and he added a couple of bookends around the beginning and end that sort of congealed it, and that ended up becoming my first comic book work. It was basically a sample that I had written, and then from there I started on Bloodstrike number one.
Okay, so that little comic thing, was that also in Brigade 2, or was that in something
No,
else?
It's Youngblood Zero. It's page 2, Youngblood 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. Youngblood Zero. But it started off as samples. Somewhere, I have this thing that I call the doodle box, and I have six tubs in my garage. I've kept Xerox copies of everything that I've drawn, plus everything that I've come across. So I've got, like, Jim Lee pencils, Mark Silvestri pencils, Rob pencils, layouts. Wow. Like, it's like a comic book treasure trove. So what I need to do eventually one of these days is start pulling all that stuff, and I can kind of give, like, a linearity to things.
That's so awesome. Yeah, I saw in one of your videos that you had all those crates back there, and you said you were going through them at some point.
Yeah.
So what about, just out of curiosity, I mean, that that Brigade pinup and you know, those pages, are those long gone and sold?
Yeah, those are long gone. Yeah. The in fact, the only things I can actually, the great thing about having my camera on a phone is I can take you on a journey. The only real originals that I have anymore is this page from Black Flag number 2. Okay. And it doesn't hold any value to me on the way it looks. It holds value in that I had drawn that on my grandparents' dining room table in November of 94. And my grandmother had passed away in March of 95, but the last time I saw her alive, I was doing the finishing touches on this. So that's why that has a never sell sort of. You could offer me $1 million and it's still not going to go anywhere, you know. Right. And then this one, which was poster art for the Black Flag series, I had recently got back from the colorist who had colored it. He found it in his garage and asked me if I was interested in getting it back, and I was definitely interested. And I have a few scraps of stuff, but basically, like, you know, part of being a comic book artist is, you know, especially if you don't have a big page rate and you're not making royalties, is you got to sell your originals to kind of keep your bank account in the black.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's why I kind of figured, I was like, are those long gone? They must be. I know. Yeah. I heard a lot of stories of extreme artists and stuff selling, you know, a lot of their pages and stuff. So,
yeah.
Okay, so that's awesome, man. Thanks for sharing all that. That was really cool to hear.
Yeah, no problem.
And also seeing those pages and stuff is so cool too. And one little diagnostic thing, real quick. I heard you said you're doing this on your phone. I know when I tried to do this on my phone one time, the battery went real quick. So I don't know if you want to keep make sure that's
I'm gonna show you. Because I'm a ninja, dude. Watch this. See that? You see that right there? That's me plugged in. That's me plugged in on a mount.
Sweet.
I don't know if you can see the mount, but yeah, the battery will not run out. But awesome. Thank you for the heads up.
All right, man. So that's cool. Wow, there's so much stuff I could go, so many directions I could go, but I'm gonna stick to
nothing's
my
off
questions.
Limits, dude. Nothing's off limits.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I guess if we're gonna follow the timeline, I guess I would go next with let's just talk a little bit about where kind of you worked on what is it, Blood Strike? What was it?
I worked on Blood Strike, Kid Supreme, Black Flag, Young Blood.
Right. Okay. And then I guess what I wanted to get into was Black Flag mostly, which I knew that you had that. That's where I came to know about you from, and was super impressed. Like, when I saw that, I was like, you know, this is one of my favorites from Extreme right here. Like, this is really cool.
Thanks, dude.
No problem. Can you just maybe talk a little bit about, like, the inspiration for that? And
yeah, it's that. It's basically, for lack of a better explanation, it's my interests in one stew. You know, I wanted to draw a badass military guy, I wanted to draw a manga chick, I wanted to draw a gorilla, I love drawing kids, and so I basically made a story about the shit I wanted to draw, basically. You know, a lot of the times when you get a script, I remember, you know, drawing Spider-Man and being so excited that I got it, and it turned out that he was only in two panels, you know, and it was a story about, like, Gwen Stacy's dad's brother, and it turned out to be, like, a guy in trench coat story, and I was really fucking bummed, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, the creator-owned thing, obviously, total autonomy can lead to some crappy stuff, but if you can kind of rein it in and give yourself some guardrails, it's the best way, because you're drawing what you want, and if you're interested in it, then your audience will probably be as interested as you are, as long as you're feeling it.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
So that was basically it, you know. I remember what had happened, like the inception of Sniper. You know, I haven't really given too much backstory because before I could really get into it, it got kiboshed. But, like, the first issue handled some of it. I had seen a magazine article. My father had showed it to me about that they can split eggs, like in the laboratory, they could split eggs and basically create clones. And I said, oh, man, that'd be interesting if they made a clone of somebody and they finally answered the nature versus nurture question, you know, make a clone, send that one, put that one through military school, put this one, expose it only to street gangs, this one, make as pure as possible, and then save the last one, right? Sniper is the first one. This guy named Roadhog was another one. This other guy named McIntyre was the other one. And Spot from Black Flag was stolen. He was stolen. That last egg was basically brought to baby form, and then that baby was stolen. So that was sort of like the impetus for him. And then Gorilla, I like Gorillas. I liked, you know, Grape Ape. I like what Art Adams was doing on Monkey Man and O'Brien. I like King Kong. So I wanted a machine gun holding Gorilla. I mean, it just sounded like fun. And, you know, and as far as, like, Geisha, I was big time into, like, Appleseed, Bubblegum Crisis, anything from Otomo, Ghost in the Shell, that kind of stuff. So I wanted to reflect my interests in that by having her be in there. And then I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool if her dad owned a toy company who also made military supplies, which is where the money comes from. And, you know, it was just a hodgepodge of shit that I liked, and I just tried to make it work. So that's kind of the thing behind that. And as far as the style, it was me trying to turn the wheel as hard in the opposite direction of the extreme style. Which, you know, was difficult. A lot of the stuff I had done early in my career, people, you know, called me a Liefeld clone, and rightfully so. I mean, I was working over his layouts, and plus there were a lot of things in the studio where it was sort of hive mentality. Hopefully none of the other guys get pissed at this, but they'll probably fess up. But, like, when we get a new guy like Jeff Matsuda in, and he's drawing these cool renderings and shines, and then Rob puts it on his, and you're like, well, follow the leader, do it like that. And Stephen Platt comes in, and everybody's got veins and torn and bullet shells. Well, add tears and bullet shells to your shit if you want to be hot. You know, so it was like this sort of keeping up with the Joneses thing. But Black Flag for me was really just like, you know, McFarlane, Art Adams, stuff I wanted to do.
Right, right. Yeah. And you got a chance to what was it, McFarlane inked over some of your stuff too?
He inked my first cover. Matter of fact, I retold this story for the Image documentary, but they played a prank on me. Rob knew Todd was my favorite of the Image guys artistically. And he said, well, why don't you ask Todd to ink your cover? Because my favorite, if I was to say my favorite comic book artist of the 90s, at least in the early part, it's not Todd McFarlane, and it's not Jim Lee, and it's not Rob Liefeld, but the harmony between Rob and Todd, when Rob would pencil and Todd would ink him,
right.
Like, look at all those New Mutants covers and shit.
Yeah.
That to me was right. Like that was the shit. Like Todd wasn't doing, neither of them were making it separately, but together they made this thing that I was like, god damn, that's the thing. So I always wanted to be inked by McFarlane, and I asked if he would ink the cover of Black Flag. He said yes, and they took a long time. Like he had it for a couple of months. And I remember sort of feeling like, is this ever going to happen? Is it, you know, is he just sitting on it? You know, should I go and ink it myself, do a new one and ink it myself? And so I had asked Rob, ask them where it is. And they said, oh, we'll fax you where we're at on it so far. Like, So Terry, Todd's right-hand man, or Todd's left-handed, so it's his left-hand man, had faxed over what they had inked so far, and it looked like the worst shit you've ever seen in your life. It looked like you gave a Sharpie to a toddler, right?
Nice.
I thought, oh, God, I turned the heat up on him, and he went extra fast on it, and I was feeling really terrible. Like, because I'm like, I got what I asked for, but it sucks, and, like, I don't want to tell them, like, this sucks, but it sucked, right? And I said to Rob, I'm like, I don't know how to approach this situation. This sucks, you know? And he's like, oh, you know, Todd's doing you a favor. You can't even – don't say anything. And I was like, fuck, okay, but – I don't even know if we can print this. You know, can we put it in the back of the book? You know, and but then we got it, and it was the cover. It was beautiful, and basically Todd and Terry were playing a joke on me. They had Terry like ink a copy of it with his left hand, and that's what they faxed over. So nice. You know, it was a funny story.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, yeah, definitely some cool stories from back in the Image days. So I guess we can move on from that, and let's see. There's a bunch of stuff I wanted to ask, but I think we'll start to talk about, you know, eventually you kind of, you did some other comics work and stuff, but eventually you did kind of depart from comics, right? And then you got into some animation and some... directing and stuff and commercials and all that. Talk about that a little bit, I guess.
Well, I'll just be real about it, man. When I quit working for Robin 99, I went and did my book at Image, and when I finished up with that, I went and did some work for Marvel. I did some issues of Wolverine, did okay, missed some deadlines, mm-hmm. and then I went to work on Black Panther, and I was putting at least 16 hours a day into those pages and feeling really burnt out. That's the only defense I have, but they were coming really slow, and basically my editor fired me. He basically fired me and then gave me like an inventory of Weapon X to do, and basically like I was known as the guy who could only do like 3 pages a week, but I didn't have a name behind me to sort of substantiate. You know, there were no big sales where people would wait. So basically, like, you know, I was fucked unless I could draw faster, which I couldn't. It wasn't like I was lollygagging. It's just that's how long stuff took. And on the inventory story, I had dialed back a lot of the detail, so I was doing like an 8-hour page. And I remember the Mike and Rach saying like, where'd the detail go? We liked your Panther style, what, you know? And it's like, well, what do you want? You want me to keep a deadline, or do you want, you know? And anyway, they didn't have anything for me. So, but at the same time, I was being wooed over to DC by Eddie Braganza, and he had thrown me a Superman issue, a fill-in. And I had done that fill-in, and then crickets, nothing, right? Like, nothing. I didn't hear anything from anybody, and nobody was picking up the phone. And so basically, like, I was basically done, you know? I was from Extreme Studios. I was a bad Rob clone, and I'm just talking about what people were saying. I couldn't keep a deadline. But I did keep my deadline on Superman, and I kept my deadline on the last 2 books I ever drew, which never saw print, a Weapon X issue and an issue of Superman. Weapon X didn't see print. I don't know why. But Superman didn't see print because DC has lost the originals. It's been since May of 2003. They don't know where they are. They have record of receiving the inks, but they don't know where they are. So that's why that book has never come out. But I was pretty fed up, and in the interim, in 2002, while I was working on Wolverine, I met a guy who at the time was sort of semi-famous, but not world-famous, this producer named Pharrell Williams, and he was doing a show for NERD, and I met him backstage after the show, and you know, thanked him for the In Search of album, and told him I worked to it. He asked me what I did. I told him I drew comics, and he had perked up. He's like, oh, what comic? And I said, I draw Wolverine. And so he gave me his number, and we started going back and forth bantering about me doing some work for him for a cartoon he was developing. When that had fallen through, he felt bad and introduced me to this director named Paul Hunter. And Paul Hunter hired me to do storyboards for this Reebok commercial featuring Allen Iverson. And I'd never done storyboards before. And I knew what a storyboard was. I knew it was cinematic storytelling. I just didn't know the level of finish. So I had pushed myself. I think I stayed up for like 2 days straight. And I basically drew a comic book version of this ad. And nobody in production had seen boards like that. And maybe in feature production where you have more time, but nobody in commercials had ever seen anything like that. And next thing I knew, my phone was blowing up. Like I was getting calls from, you know, everybody at that production company. And the way the structure of how, at least at the time, production companies worked, you had a production company who had several directors working on several projects, and they all had producers working for them, and those producers did the hiring, but if a director liked you, they'd hire you back, and if a producer liked you, they would recommend you to a director you'd never worked for them. So by December of 2003, I was a full-blown storyboard artist. I was storyboarding music videos and commercials every day. And eventually, while I was working on Superman, I had met this this guy, Steve Chasman. He was Jason Statham's manager. And I was at a premiere of The Italian Job, and I had met him and was discussing with him where I thought there were some problems in the first Transporter movie. He asked me, how do you know so much about filmmaking? And I told him, this is before I was storyboarding, I said, oh, I make comics and yada yada. And he told me, if we ever do a sequel to The Transporter, I'm going to give you a call. So anyway, June of 2004 comes, and I'm storyboarding at this time. I get a call from Steve Chasman basically saying, we're doing another Transporter movie. Would you like to, storyboard the movie? So that was the first movie I had done. Obviously, hopefully you can see it's a lot of luck, but luck is two ingredients. It's opportunity and preparation. It's being ready for that opportunity and not shitting your pants when it happens, you know? Right. So I started doing storyboards for movies and for commercials and music videos. I had worked for a guy named Chris Robinson. A lot of hip-hop music videos, so we had done some Mary J. Blige, some Usher videos and things. And he was talking about a movie he had coming up and wanted to know if I wanted to board on it. And of course, I said, yes, Chris is awesome. And so I get on that movie. It's called ATL. It features T.I., Jason Weaver, Albert Daniels, Lauren London, a group of people. But I was doing double duty on that movie. I was storyboarding. And the character in the movie, T.I.'s character, was a cartoonist, an aspiring cartoonist. So anytime they needed to cut to him cartooning, they needed a cartoon on the table that he was drawing. So they asked me if I would draw those. So I was storyboarding and doing on-camera artwork for that. So did some more movies and commercials. Early 2009, I get a phone call from my producer from that movie saying he's producing a pilot for MTV called The Hard Times of R.J. Berger, and wanted to know if I can repeat the same sort of work that I had done on ATL on this pilot, which would be storyboarding the pilot, and this character also was an aspiring comic book artist, so they needed artwork on camera. So I said, yeah, sure. So anyway, we're having lunch. I'm sitting with the creators of the show and the two producers, and the content of the show, for the uninitiated that know nothing about it, it's about this nerdy kid that nobody likes, but then through some circumstances, his pants fall down in a basketball game, and he's got like a 14-inch dick, right? So they're like, oh my God. Well, there had been some things in the pilot that were so absurd and kind of, you couldn't film it.
Yeah.
That they didn't know what to do, and this one of the producers, I forget his last name, his name's Neil, had said, oh, why don't we do the Kill Bill thing? And all of us said, Kill Bill thing? And he said, yeah, you know, animate it, like the Oranishi scene, you know, animate it. And everybody turned and looked at me and said, do you do animation? And I said,
is there an artist in the room?
Yeah, going back into my head to the Fisher-Price, you know, cartridge thing, I said, I know how it's done. It's 24 drawings per second and, you know, whatever. And they're like, well, can you storyboard and animate this sequence for us? So I said, yeah. They gave me a budget. I basically broke down what was needed, and I tried to make it work with the budget we had. So what I did is I created all the pieces, the backgrounds, and the characters, but I made them like puppets. I hired my friend Dennis to do all the animation in After Effects while I directed sort of the performances and everything. The pilot got picked up, which was very scary because they wanted me to do it 12 more times in 12 different styles. Wow. because the animation would facilitate something different for each episode. Like, for example, if it was a fight, they wanted it to look like Samurai Jack. If it was an episode about this dude being infested with crabs in his pubic hair, then the episode's called The Deadliest Crotch. They wanted it to be like The Deadliest Catch meets Popeye. So all the styles were different, and they gave me a choice. They said, here's a big, giant chunk of money. You can make a budget and break down all the things and hire, basically creatively guide this thing and create your own animation studio, or you can work with a production partner and oversee it. So what I did is I auditioned some production partners, and through a series of events, I ended up working with this awesome. The company was okay, but the individual, this gal named Marge Dean, over at Wildbrain. I ended up working with Wildbrain to create the animation for Hard Times, and they did the animation for like Yo Gabba Gabba and a bunch of other shows. So this relationship was formed with Wildbrain and my friend Marge, and through again luck and Marge, I got to give Marge the credit for seeing the potential there. The position had opened up on the Ricky Gervais show. The directing position, and Marge thought, because of my ability to move through all these styles seamlessly and tell, because I wasn't just aesthetic, I wasn't just going for things stylistically, aesthetically, I was also going for like a deeper dive in like what makes this thing. It's not just the way it's drawn, but it's the storytelling style, the shots, the editing, all of it. So she saw that I understood that and thought that I might be good for the Ricky Gervais show. I interviewed for the Ricky Gervais show, met with the showrunner and the EP. They liked me. They sent me over to the HBO offices. And I remember feeling like I was going to pass out, like as I'm walking into the room. And they're like, how you doing? I said, yeah, I feel like I'm going to pass out, but let's talk. So I got the gig. They hired me, so I directed two episodes two seasons of the Ricky Gervais show for them, using the storytelling and all the things and having just an amazing team of designers and animators work with me. And when that had wrapped up, I had done a pilot for Disney, a pilot for Adult Swim, and then ended up, my friend Marge ended up going over to work for Mattel. And some things happened over at Mattel, and I ended up meeting I call him my boss, but he's like my friend, and he's my mentor, this guy named Audu Payton. Mm-hmm. If you're a fan of Animaniacs and Pinky and the Brain and mm-hmm. the real Ghostbusters and that, Starship Troopers cartoon, he was the creative force behind this stuff. Nice. Same with so I met him and interviewed with him, and he liked me, and I liked him, and I knew I could learn from him, and so that's how I landed at Mattel. But I got long-winded, but that's basically the whole swatch of how stuff transitioned.
That's awesome to hear that and how that all unfolded. That's absolutely crazy. Wow. A lot of good juice in there.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's cool, man. Like one thing I'm kind of taking away from how your career has unfolded is you're obviously a very much a person who doesn't wait for all their ducks to be in a row. You just take action. You know,
you can't.
From the beginning, you were calling, cold calling, you know, famous people who were like people you looked up to. You just, I'm just going to call them up. And it seems like that's kind of how you just continued throughout. And every time, like you said, the opportunity came, and it's like, I'm not necessarily an animator, but like you already have a lot of the skills, you know, because of you doing comics, you're thinking about storytelling and you're thinking about, you know, just all the aspects of that, which is crazy amount of, you know, skills. And you're like, yeah, I can try that. And you try it and it seems and I had, to work
and
out.
I had, especially in animation, I have amazing support teams and amazing people around me that help make up the deficit. You know, it's like on Gervais, there's this guy named Sean Tashikian, and any sort of hole or crack in my armor, he would go, hey, there's a crack in your armor, and this is how you get rid of that crack. And he was very helpful in a lot of the places I had shortcomings. I had a really good team to help elevate those things. So,
right, yeah, and it helps that, you know, the different projects, you know, like you were saying, that, you know, they're like, okay, we got this big budget, hire the people you need, or however they said to do it, you know, get the people you need to do the things you need to do, and so you were able to build a team, which that's really neat, you know?
Well, I didn't build a team, man. I got to pick a team, because the thing I didn't want to do was if I had set up my own animation studio, all of a sudden I would have to be the administrator, the person that I would either have to hire a producer that had to deal with schedules and budgets. And again, like budgetarily, I didn't know how to pay that person. I didn't know how to find that person. I basically there was a package already there in place with WildBrain. I had just happened to find the best, and with Marge Dean, and she helped me assemble a world class team. And you know, there's a handful of people in my life that without which I don't know what I'd be doing, and she's one of them. So
that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's so cool. And you know, I you know, doing a little bit of research just to, you know, kind of make sure I had some extra questions or whatever. I did look up that the Ricky Gervais show, and I watched, you know, a decent amount of the first episode, and it's so cool. Like that, I mean, you definitely had some good ammunition going into that for, you know, visuals and stuff, and
yeah,
it came out great, man. Like it looks like you kind of took on a lot of that kind of almost old school style, but also like that whole Ren and Stimpy type of thing, and you know, because they drew from that old, like, you know, Flintstones and all that.
Yeah, it's like a type of stuff. Exactly, it's like Hanna-Barbera and UPA. Yeah. You know, fortunately, like I came in season two and season three, and Craig Kelman, the original director, is a genius. You know, his forte was he's a character designer. He designed most of the characters in Madagascar, and he sort of set the look. And when I came in on season two, I had some really talented character designers with Brian Arnett and Alex Kerwin, and you know, I was lucky in the talent that I had gotten on it. And then our showrunner and the guy who was writing the gags, Steve Patrick, he really he brought the magic to it. Like for me, it was my role was basically is sort of working with my storyboard team, where to put the camera, how to time the gags, and sort of the best way to push an idea across. And the campaign, basically the campaign that got me the gig, And it's something that I absolutely believe in. And it's something that I request of anybody I work with today is that the characters, when they're animated, need to be alive. I don't care if you're animating, you know, a circle and two dots as a face. There's ways to make it look like it's thinking, eye darts, you know. It's studying. It's basically like an FBI guy does with body language and forensics. You know, they can tell if someone's lying by the way they're moving. And, you know, when I came on Gervais, the one of the strengths that we had on that show was these are three real dudes, and these are three real dudes that are on camera, and they, you know, Ricky laughs a certain way in real life. Carl scratches his head when he thinks. Stephen Merchant does these sort of shoulder things when he's laughing and you can't hear it. Those are the things I ask my animators to really look at to make it alive. You know, the gags feel more warm and less, because it's just 2D. They're puppets. That's flash. You know, it's flash animation.
Right. Cool. Yeah. No. That's really cool that you had the vision to kind of put that. And I didn't realize that you came on in season two. But
yeah,
it seems like that. Yeah. That's really cool that you were able to kind of inject that kind of wisdom in there. Kind of put some soul, add some soul to what was already something really cool.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. So I guess we can move on a little bit to kind of past the career. Well, I guess one just a quick question I'm curious. Is that the kind of work you're doing now, or can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, basically, I mean, I can't talk too much about it because I work for Mattel, and just imagine Mattel, if you take Willy Wonka and Mattel and you put them next to each other, I get to see all the Oompa Loompas and like all the Chocolate River stuff, but I don't get to talk about it too much. All I can say is I'm a supervising director for Monster High, the animation that's done for the webisodes, the animation done for the features. We have a movie coming out in a couple months called Haunted. And I can't talk about the stuff for the fall. Netflix, I can talk about that. We have a show on Netflix called Ever After High, and these are all kids shows. These are for young girls. I had done two seasons of Polly Pocket, where I was overseeing the storytelling and animation for Polly Pocket, and I had to be tight-lipped. I work for Mattel. Right. And I do the same kind of work that I did on Gervais and on RJ Berger, but I do it for Mattel for their toy properties, for the animation.
Cool. Yeah, I'm not trying to pressure you to get into stuff you
shouldn't. No, I know you're not. I'm just saying. And then the other thing, like your original email that you had sent me, like a career in art and that stuff. Like some of the things that I do extracurricularly. Is I do a daily sketch, I do a daily rap. I created a book last year called The Grave, where I had basically made one story that took place. I put it out a panel a day over a year, so it's a 365 panel comic that I put out one panel at a time, and it was basically the fruit of two motivations. Number one, going back to the make your opportunity, don't wait for it. I have probably about 20 ideas that I believe in that I've had mulling around for a long time. Right. The grave was one of them, and I kept saying when I have the time. But I realized I never have the time to just sit down and do it traditionally. And then I forget who it was. Somebody had turned me on to this book called The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield.
Yeah, I've read that. It's good.
Yeah, and he talks about the resistance, and he talks about Charles Swindoll and how he would write two books a year on top of this very, very busy schedule as the administrator for the EV Free Church. You know, being the head of 19 churches and like just... I know what he meant, like how much he's doing every day, but the fact that he was writing a page a day struck me. I went, oh, it's like manageable chunks, and how can I takes what I have instead of saying I'll do it when I have time and keep like back burner and go, well, how can I do it? And I decided a panel a day was the way to do it. So I did that, and then the sketch a day was sort of motivated by two things. My buddy Kenneth Rockefert was doing it, and I really liked the idea of just sort of like flexing your skills on a daily basis. And also just trying to keep my sword sharp, you know, giving myself challenges. I think the, you know, it's like Bruce Lee is another one of my influences, and, you know, there's the whole running water never grows stale, Rolling Stone gathers no moss, and as long as you're keeping things going, you're only going to build. You're not going to get worse, you know. So I like that idea, and so I started doing the daily sketch, and then I thought, like, you know, I know so many people that have been stuck in the rut like I have. You know, my family on my mother's side, we had a bit of bouts with depression and just different things to deal with. And if somebody had taken my hand and said, look, man, follow the yellow brick road, or, you know, these trees have a mark on it, follow those trees, this is the way out, I would have been ever so grateful. Fortunately for other people, I've been in the position to actually blaze the trees for them. And I thought, like, hey, why not share? Like, help, like, inspire people, get them up off their feet, get them drawing again, because, you know, people, I don't care how old you are, you know, Stan Lee was 41 when Fantastic Four came out. You know that?
Right,
you know,
yeah.
Jack Kirby was 44.
Yeah.
Like, no, nobody has any excuses. I mean, Jack was working. Obviously, he was grinding since the early days with Simon. But Stan Lee was, I mean, I met Stan. Stan's a cool dude. He's a funny showman. But he was basically like a wash-up. He's washed up. And then Marvel happened. So, you know, it's never too late. I want people to know it's never too late, and that there's ways about going things, and you know, if things aren't going right, turn left, you know, like that kind of shit. You know, it's a lot of sayings and catchphrases, but they're real. Right. So that's why I decided to create my show, is to sort of inform people at least some of what gets me going, and hopefully they'll go, oh shit, I could do it too, you know.
Absolutely, man, and I'll tell you, I was kind of first put on to the fact that you were, you know, doing these sketches, and you were, like, doing some stuff online by my buddy Mike Vallad, and and him and I, like, have just been, like, definitely benefiting from seeing your videos and stuff, and it's definitely encouraging, especially the, you know, the Fraga Boom Show and all that stuff now, and so, yeah, we definitely appreciate it. And I know a lot of my artist friends are also watching and stuff. So
cool.
Yeah,
well, I'll tell you, if I can say it now, and it's an invite to you and Michael and anybody, is I need, like, I've been just coming up with show ideas on my own. But what I need is, I need people to kind of say what they'd like to hear, or if they have any sort of suggestions on, like, do a show on blah, blah, blah. You know, I would love that, because, you know, it's basically for the people. So anything that they're wanting to hear, I'd like to be able to accommodate it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, on this podcast, the word is put out there.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'll definitely, if you know, put that out there for sure. And I know how that is, because, you know, I put out a lot of content myself, and I know my buddies do too. And
yeah,
sometimes you need some ideas on exactly what people maybe want to see and check out.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it depends on what you're trying to do, but it's like, you know, eventually I'll have some guests on. I'll invite some of my comic buddies over, and we'll get their point of view on things. But you know, it's always good to hear. Sort of, you know, there's a saying, you know, they say when you're inside the jar, it's hard to see the label. And a lot of times I feel like I'm in the jar, and I want to be able to know what it is they want it to be.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. All right, well, man, we really went through a lot of stuff, and I know we could go on forever, but unfortunately we can't. But I will say there's one other thing I wanted to definitely ask about, and then, you know, also we'll see, you know, kind of see if we can close it out. But I was curious to – I wanted to ask especially because I'm sure a lot of people ask you, and you have addressed it on one of your shows too. Man, we are all watching you do these drawings, and there's no sketch underneath. And it's like every time I see it, I'm like, I feel like what? How does he do this? Like, and I, you know, I've seen the video where you talk about it, but maybe you want to like talk about that a little bit to people, like.
It's a muscle thing, man. You know, there was a time. I'll give you an analogy, and then I'll bring it around and like give you an ABC of how to do it. Back in 2003, I was like 260 pounds. I was a bit overweight, and I knew the only way I could do it is through diet and exercise. And the thought of exercise really sort of mortified me, you know. It's like, if you run for 20 minutes, you know, you'll burn calories. And I was like, fuck you, man. I can't even run for like a minute and a half without feeling like I'm going to puke, you know?
Yeah.
And so what I did is I said, let's see how far I can go. Let's not worry about time. Let's see about distance, right? And I ran about 100 yards and sat there wheezing and like feeling like I was going to chirp. And then I thought to myself, I said, okay, that's this bush, and there's a stop sign down there, like 10 feet away from where I'm at. Tomorrow I'm going to try to make the stop sign, right? Yeah. And then I made the stop sign the next day, and I felt the same, but then I said, well, what about the corner, right? And what I did is through time, daily, I kept making it bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger to a point where I had created this 2-mile circuit, and I was running 2 miles every day. And it took me 8 months, and I shed 80 pounds. But had I had the mindset of it was impossible from that one run, like, oh, fuck, no, not going to happen, I would have been stuck, you know? So taking that sort of mentality over to your question of how do I draw without any guidelines, I saw Kim Jong-gi online, right? And he's this artist, if you don't know him, it's K-I-M-J-U-N-G-G-I. He is a fucking beast. And I saw his stuff, and I was like, that's what he does. He does these time-lapse sketches, right. But he takes hours, and they're perfectly lensed. There's perspective, and it's every subject. And I just thought, fuck, man, like, that guy's bananas, right? And then I thought, well, I've sketched with pen before where I've just, like, used the pen and I've drawn and it came out okay. Every now and then I do a sketch. I wonder if I can take the same approach I did to when I lost weight to being able to do this thing. Mm-hmm. And what I started doing is I got myself a pen and said, you're not allowed to sketch, just draw, right? So that was one part of it. Another part of it, which is something that every comic book artist I've ever had the conversation with will fess up to, is that we all see stuff in our heads. Like when we go to draw, we all kind of see it, and a lot of our disappointment comes from, like, when we're done, we're like, it's not what I hoped for. It's not what was in my head. What was in my head was better. People don't know what was in your head. First off, only we do. But one of the things that would drive me crazy is I'd see this thing, and I'd go to the draw, and it would be gone. And I'd try to find it again, and it was like fleeting. It would just be like flickers. Right? Mm. Here it is. Oh, go, good luck drawing that, dickhead. You know, like my brain was fucking with me. Mm. And I go, God, fuck, man. And then what you do is you would rely on rudiments, right? Like, I studied perspective, I studied, you know, Loomis, I studied figures, I studied gesture. So you rely on rudiments, which is basically like scaffolding And you go, well, I know it was kind of like this, and there were rocks there, and the gesture was kind of like this, and you sketch it out, mm-hmm. and you work it out, and then you get it there eventually, and then you finish it up, and you're like, it wasn't what it was supposed to be. There's a book I read called The Einstein Factor, and it's about increasing your intelligence. But one of the exercises that were in it, which is everything that he mentioned in his book is on his website for free, so I know the dude's not a snake oil salesman, is a thing called image streaming. And I talked about it in my video a bit, but image streaming essentially is push-ups for your brain. And that's not what he calls them. He uses them for a different thing. But what I realized is I can condition my brain to visualize stronger and more resolute in a way where the thing that's inside my head is as if it was in front of me. I see it done already, and I'm able to hold on to it. So that's how I do. That's how I draw without any underdrawing, is that as I'm drawing it, it's already done. It's already done in my head, and I'm basically just kind of doing what I'm seeing. You know, there are times where the signal goes in and out and whatnot, but that's basically it. Is I work that visualization muscle along with drawing exclusively with just the pen and forcing myself to get to that point where now that's what I can do. So it's conditioning. It's not like it was a magic power. It's just conditioning.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I like how you put it, you know, push-ups for your brain, you know, that kind of makes it seem less like weird and mystical, and it's more
It's not mystical. It's not a magic power, dude.
Yeah.
It's not. They cannot cut ladies in half. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. It's a trick. Yeah.
Exactly. Cool, man. Well, I have one last question, too.
Okay.
I thought of another one, but also I wanted to, you know, ask, you know, Peter, is there anything else you wanted to think, you had any thoughts or wanted to talk about or ask about?
Well, you mentioned when you were very young, you had four jobs. You know, leaving the security of a home and out on your own. For how long did you do that? And
9 months.
9 months?
Nine months, yeah.
That must have been, like, really, yeah, I don't know. Like, I can't even imagine. Like, I didn't start working until later than that myself. And just to have one job was an experience into itself. I mean, how did you adjust that?
I had the benefit my parents split up when I was two, and my dad took my brother and I on as a single father until he met my stepmother when we were five. But we lived on an acre and a half of land, which had like chickens and geese and a garden and, you know, a pretty big thing of land, and basically it was up to my brother and I to take care of shit. So we would wake up before the sun, and we would, you know, feed the chickens, and we would till the garden and clean the pond and water the plants and clean cages and anything, basically like farm life, you know? For me, working in general, has been something that just seems like, I'm just not lazy. Like for my viewers, I like my cannabis and I like my whiskey, and that's about as lazy as I get, you know? Otherwise, I like to work. I like to work whether or not I'm getting paid or not. And no, I will not work for free. I'm just saying, I like to stay busy.
Right.
So that's hard. Awesome. It was just, you know, I needed to make this much money to be on my own. And being, you know, just out of high school graduate, it was, you know, working retail, working food, working a warehouse, and working a menial production job, you know. But right. Each of them taught me something different. You know, that's the thing is, you know, American Eagle Outfitters, I learned about retail and the ruthlessness of quotas working at Velvet Turtle as a busboy. I got to see how a restaurant works from the inside out. Working at Diamond Comics, I got to peek under the hood of what happens when comics go from the printer to the warehouse to the retailer to the person. And working at Interactive Composition as, and these are the early days of print, like before Photoshop, you know, hand cutting color separations, creating blue lines, sitting there correcting film with liquid film. I got to see how pre-press worked. So for me, I'm grateful. I had to bust my ass, but I'm grateful because each of those things were sort of components that helped fill up my knowledge base.
Right. Absolutely. And just to touch on, like, when you were in that position where you didn't make your deadline, did that hit you hard?
And very hard.
How did you mentally recover?
I felt like I had been punched in the stomach by Mike Tyson. Mm. I remember basically begging my editor, and we're still friends. He's a great guy, and I'm actually grateful that he fired me. But I remember standing up and feeling like sick to my stomach, and then feeling the inability to stand and sort of like falling to the ground and saying, "Dude, please, please, please." And he's like, nah. You know, part of the recovery was him giving me the inventory story. Also, you know, it's the time travel thing. The thing that I talked about in one of my Frega Boom shows, and it's this. It's we all of us have sort of a picture of who we are, and some of us, the fortunate few, have a picture of who we will be, and within that sort of thing of who we will be, as a kid, early on, whether it's being cocky, whether it's being delusional, it's that sort of, no, I'm gonna do good shit in this world. I'm gonna make a difference. I'm gonna matter. Mm. So if you completely believe that and you behave as such, that's why I call it time travel. I know that one day I will be such and such. I won't tell you because it's a secret, but I will do this. And therefore, if this is true, then everything in between also must be true. So here's the present, here's the future, or flip it, here's the present, here's the future. If I am this, then all this in between must be consistent. And the only way to do that is to behave as such. So when I go into a meeting and I'm just a, you know, a menial storyboard artist and I'm meeting with a director, I'm not going to say stupid things. I'm going to listen, and I'm going to behave in a way where one day he'll say, "God, I remember that guy. I knew he was going to do something." You know what I mean? Like, you have to be that. So overcoming that stuff, and the attitude I had was, just keep on. Like, you fucked up. I fucked up because, I mean, like I said, it's twofold. I was drawing too much detail, and also it just, I was getting burnt out, and I made promises, and I didn't keep them. Those were the biggest issues. So, A, don't make promises you can't keep. That was one thing I learned. And try to find a way to be the best you can be realistically. You know, don't overcommit. Mm-hmm. Because I knew that I was going to be better than what I was at the time, I just picked myself up off and dusted myself off and went forward. And then again, like I said, I was very lucky. I met some very, very, very kind and generous people as far as their belief in me and the sort of generosity that they showed me with their time and attention.
All right. That's great. That's great.
Yeah. Definitely cool that you had that, you were able to have that perspective, you know, through it. And obviously, you know, when it happened, you know, you probably didn't feel like a lot of perspective right away, but
no.
You were able to come out of it with some perspective, which is great.
Yeah.
So
I'll ask my one last question, and then I'll ask a viewer's question, because that seems like a great one to end it on. My last question is not so deep. It's do you think, speaking about the past and the future, is serious like comic book work in the future for Dan Fraga?
I don't see it. I see still doing comics, you know, like I did The Grave last year. It was not exactly your, you know, page panel format, but it was a comic. I have plenty of ideas that I'd like to do, and I'd make strides, but yes. My answer is yes. But it won't be for anybody but me. I won't draw Spider-Man. I won't draw Batman. I'm just not interested in doing other people's stuff.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's good to hear. That's what I wanted to hear.
All right.
And for the last question, to end it off on, and just real quick to, you know, shout out to those people who are watching live and everything. Thanks for watching. And Dee Dee Willingham asks, Dan, what would you tell your 16-year-old self today?
Haha, they picked the right age, too. That's great. I would say it will be done. Everything that you want, young man, it will happen. It won't happen the way you expect it to. It's up to you to make sure it does. Chin up, and stop thinking that the people you put on pedestals are not human, because they all are.
All right. I like that. Nice. All right, man. Well, we're going to end the broadcast here in a minute. You know, it'll go past, and we can, you know, kind of talk after a little bit, but, you know, thanks so much for coming on. I think I can speak for my listeners in that I think we all had a great time listening and hearing what you were saying about all the stuff you've gone through and everything. So, yeah, just thanks, man, so much.
Yeah, lots of lessons to be learned in this conversation. And, you know, respectable career so far, and I'm sure many years in the future to come. You do incredible work, and yeah, you're someone to, you know, lost Dan. Definitely somebody to follow in the footsteps.
I don't even know what happened there. That was weird. My 16-year-old Seth threw a kung fu chop on that one. yeah, but basically, you know, comparison's the thief of joy, and you know, it's good to learn from role models, but, you know, you will be disappointed eventually.
Right. Cool, man. Well, yeah, it's funny, because you came back on. I didn't realize you dropped off. Like, the way it ended, it was like, bam. Like
microphone drop.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, I thought you were still there, and we were just saying, you know, we're just saying, you know, thank you so much for coming on, and you know,
no problem,
we're probably the thing like actually goes on past when we stop the broadcast, but so we'll kind of say our goodbyes there. But you know, just for the listeners, you know, absolutely, you know, thank you so much for coming on, and you know,
no
we
problem.
really appreciate hearing all that kind of in depth story and stuff, and very inspiring. And a lot of helpful tips in there, too.
Cool, man. Thank you guys for having me on.
Absolutely. And, you know, thank you, Peter, as well, for helping me out with this. Definitely made things go smoother. And I guess, you know, for myself, just to, you know, sign out here, again, this is the Escape Artist Podcast. We're here with Dan Fraga, Peter Palmiotti, and from DarkyJawProjects.com. Peter, let us know where we can find you.
I'm you're probably at it everywhere. Google my name, but you can find me on YouTube where I'm most active.
Cool. Awesome. And Dan Frege, where can people find you?
You can find me on Facebook, The Art of Dan Frege. You can find me on Instagram, Couch Doodles, Fregeboom23, and on YouTube as Hiroteka, Hiroteka.
Cool, man. Well, thanks again, and thank you everybody who was listening and who will be listening in the future. This is the Escape Artist Podcast signing off.
All right.
See you on the next episode.
See you guys.
Peace.
Background music provided by Mr. Pool. You can find show notes at donkeyjawprojects.com, where you can also sign up for the newsletter. If you'd like to support, go to patreon.com/plex or go to iTunes and leave a review. And thank you so much for listening. Now get your butt out there and make some awesome stuff. It's Escape Artist.